Navy of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveils new strategic defense equipment, including missiles and drones, to boost the country's deterrence power. Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan take to the streets to protest his arrest over graft charges. And Russia says it's captured more areas in Ukraine. The Ukrainian forces launch fresh strikes near the Crimea region. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The Navy of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, has unveiled new strategic systems and equipment. They include reconnaissance, intelligence, offensive, and combat drones. The IRGC Navy also received hundreds of cruise and ballistic missiles with ranges of 300 to 1,000 kilometers. The new products were unveiled in a ceremony attended by the top military brass and a number of government officials. The chief commander of the IRGC addressed the ceremony, underlining the importance of reinforcing the country's military power. Major General Hossein Salami says that the presence of enemies in the West Asia region has opened up opportunities, culminating in an increase in Iran's defense products. He has stressed that the Islamic Republic has made headways despite sanctions placed imposed by the enemies. The Iranian foreign minister is calling for more cooperation among Asian states as he hosts his Sri Lankan counterpart in Tehran. In a joint presser, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that boosting ties with Asian nations is high on the agenda of the government. He pointed to Sri Lanka's upcoming chairmanship of the Indian Ocean Rim Association. Amir Abdollahian said that presidency provides a chance for further cooperation among Asian nations and Iran's interaction with members of the organization. The top diplomat noted that Tehran and Colombo can overcome existing obstacles to their ties. Then for his part, Ali Sabri appreciated the Iran nation's resilience in the face of foreign pressure. He also hailed the country's achievements. The official urged Iranian companies to invest in Sri Lanka. Our correspondent in Tehran, Gisum Shamiri, tells us more about the Sri Lankan foreign minister's trip to Iran and Tehran and Colombo's plans for future cooperation.
The interesting thing about this trip is that normally these official visits take only 1 or 2 days, but as we have seen the schedule of the Sri Lankan foreign minister, he will be staying in Iran for at least 4 days. He will be meeting with other high-ranking officials. These are in line with Iran's international policy to expand its bilateral relations with all countries based on mutual respect and on an equal ground. Iran has great potential in the field of healthcare. Also, the knowledge-based companies in Iran have been actually receiving more opportunities to expand their operations, and now Ebrahim Raisi is providing the ground for these companies to be more active on an international scale. So Sri Lanka is also one of the countries that has welcomed Iran's knowledge-based companies. You heard the foreign minister of Sri Lanka pointing to the fact that Iran has made great achievements in many high-tech fields, including nanotechnology, and therefore countries that have good relations with Iran will definitely be able to benefit from these technological advancements.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan have taken to the streets protesting after a court finds him guilty of graft and sentenced him to 3 years behind bars. Protesters in the city of Mazar-e-Sharif marched and shouted slogans, slamming the court convicting Imran Khan for illegally selling state gifts. The Saturday ruling will potentially bar the opposition leader from running in an upcoming election. Police arrested Khan in Lahore. The protests were held after Imran Khan's allies released a pre-recorded video in which he asked his supporters not to sit at home silently.
By the time you hear this statement, they will have arrested me. I've only one appeal.
Don't sit silently at home. I'm struggling for you and the country and your children's future. You have to continue peaceful protests until you get your rights, and the biggest fundamental right, which is to elect your government of choice through votes. Do not allow any occupying group to rule the country, like they are doing today.
Imran Khan has denied all charges. The former prime minister was elected in 2018, but he was ousted in a no-confidence vote last year after falling out with a powerful military. He's facing more than 100 cases brought against him since his removal, charges that he says are politically motivated. The verdict centered on charges that he incorrectly declared details of presents from foreign dignitaries and proceeds from their alleged sale. The gifts are reported to be worth more than $635,000. Our correspondent Slobod Nasser Kazmi tells us more about Imran Khan's prison term over a graft case.
It was the second time when the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has been arrested by the police after he was found guilty in a Toshakhana case. The state gift case. The judge today, during the hearing, he was waiting for Imran Khan to come and to appear before the court. However, the former prime minister was not able to appear before the court, and his lawyer was also absent at this moment. Police is bringing Imran Khan to Islamabad from Lahore. So there is a difference between this arrest and the previous arrest. In previous arrest, we have seen that there were thousands of his supporters were outside at his residence and was trying to stop police to while arresting Imran Khan. But this time, there is no activist from Pakistan Tehreek Insaf Party on the street at the moment, and police easily managed to arrest the former Prime Minister of Pakistan.
The Palestinians have laid to rest the body of a teenager killed by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank on Friday. The 19-year-old Palestinian Qusay Jamal Matan was shot dead in the village of Burqa. According to Palestinian media, Israeli settlers, accompanied by regime forces, raided the village. The armed settlers opened fire on Palestinian properties and set several cars on fire. On Friday, another Palestinian was shot dead during an Israeli raid on a refugee camp east of Tulkar. Israeli troops stage attacks against Palestinians across the occupied lands almost on a daily basis. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians in the raids since the beginning of this year. The vulnerability of Israeli spy agencies has come to light again. Now the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement says it's managed to infiltrate the regime's secret services. Al-Quds Brigades, which is Islamic Jihad's armed wing, says it successfully penetrated the Mossad and Shin Bet spy agencies by sending in six undercover members of its own security apparatus.
A new documentary produced by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement revealed that Palestinian resistance fighters managed to infiltrate Israel's Shin Bet, a spy agency Mossad. The documentary titled Spider's Web 2 details a complex espionage operation that was carried out against the Israeli organizations by Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance movement of the Islamic Jihad, which is headquartered in the Tel Aviv-blockaded Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. The documentary illustrates the espionage enterprise, which involved six Palestinian fighters and was part of a wider operation launched by the Islamic Jihad in 2022 to retaliate against Israeli warfare in Gaza. The Israeli military launched close to 150 airstrikes against the coastal sliver during the war, prompting the resistance to respond by firing some 1,100 rockets toward the occupied territories. The Palestinian agents reportedly baited a number of Israeli officers into revealing secret methods and procedures. One of the Palestinian operatives, referred to as Recruit 106, duped a Shin Bet officer into believing that he was afraid of being arrested by the Palestinian resistance fighters, thus luring the Israeli officer into revealing a treasure trove of information on the regime's security system, methods, and tools. The Palestinian agents also managed to find out how Shin Bet agents had, in the past, tried to pose themselves as Palestinian Authority officers, Jordanian intelligence agents, and even a European Union representative on one occasion. According to the documentary, the Palestinian move led to the detention of several agents working for Israel and the dismantling of at least three Israeli spying centers. The successful conduct of the operation, according to the documentary, led to the Al-Quds Brigade's debunking the myth of might that surrounds the Israeli regime and its capabilities, with the Palestinian fighters identifying the regime as no more than an illusion made of dust. The term was famously used by Mahmoud Al-Arida, one of the six Palestinian prisoners who successfully escaped an Israeli maximum security prison in September 2021.
The latest report of Palestinian resistance fighters infiltrating Israeli spy agencies has revealed the regime's vulnerabilities, and that while Prime Minister Netanyahu, who took power in late December, has thrown Israel into unprecedented turmoil with his push to overhaul the regime's judicial system, Tel Aviv is now grappling with a full-blown crisis.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, which took power in late December, has thrown Tel Aviv into unprecedented turmoil with its push to overhaul the regime's judicial system. Many of the former senior officials present at the December conference have become highly public dissidents, warning of the damage to Israel's security by the agenda and even supporting the refusal by thousands of military reservists to serve the regime. By every metric, the Israeli economy has suffered, while scientists, doctors, and tech entrepreneurs either prepare immigration plans or march in the streets alongside hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens. The Israel Medical Association said nearly 500 doctors are expected to leave Israel, warning that the exodus can lead to a severe medical crisis. Israel is no longer as strong or as stable as it was mere months ago. Israeli opposition leader Benny Gantz recently warned of a worrying security situation across the occupied territories amid a months-long wave of anti-regime protests sparked by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet and its contentious policies. Last week, after Israeli parliament passed the first of the judicial overhaul bill, sparing mass protests, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah described it as the worst day in the history of the Zionist entity. He said, "Israel has embarked on a path, God willing, of collapse, fragmentation, and doom."
Now, Moscow says it's taken control of more areas in Ukraine as Kiev launches new attacks near the Crimea region. The Russian defense minister said that the army captured a settlement of Novoselivska in the northeast after heavy fighting. Russian forces have recently increased their attacks in Ukraine's east with the aim of stopping Kiev's counteroffensive. Meantime, Ukraine has reportedly hit a Russian tanker with a Navy drone in the Kerch Strait in the Black Sea. A source in Ukraine's security service said that the vessel was transporting fuel for Russian troops. The attack happened near a strategic bridge linking Russia to the Crimean Peninsula, and that a day after Kiev hit one of the warships in Russia's Black Sea naval base. The port is a major hub for Russian exports. Russia is also saying it's dispatched Su-30 jet to prevent U.S. reconnaissance drone from violating its airspace. That's the breaking news we just have for you. Now, same with the U.S., former President Donald Trump has been arraigned on four criminal charges related to his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential vote. Trump pleaded not guilty to the felony counts during an arraignment hearing in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. Rami Mazaheta reports from Chicago.
For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to four counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most presidential vote polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th and if it is time to move on from the events that day.
Yes, I do think it is necessary. He should be indicted for that because he's supposed to be leading by an example. We're supposed to be able to actually model what he's doing, but we can't do that if he's not doing what he should be doing.
Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system.
It shouldn't point negatively towards the U.S. It should point to positively towards our justice system, that despite him being the top nominee and a previous sitting U.S. president, corruption doesn't matter if you're, you know, what level of experience you're at or what level in the hierarchy you are.
Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate. Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The American rating agency Fitch has downgraded the U.S. government's AAA credit rating by one notch, putting it at AA+. The agency has cited expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years for that decision. It's also cited high and growing general government debt burden, and the downgrade has caused concerns among investors. The downgrading of the U.S. credit rating follows a debt ceiling agreement in June, and that after months of political stalemate between Republicans and Democrats in Congress. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has dismissed the downgrade as arbitrary and based on outdated data, and she argues that the agency has ignored improvements in governance metrics.
That's a wrap for this News Bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A Zionist court has ordered the removal of Palestinian Negev village to build Jewish neighborhood. Residents of Ras Jaraba, which predates the fabricated regime of Israel, says that, despite concerns for their future, they will fight the decision to the end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams reported human rights groups recently condemned an Israeli court for greenlighting the forced expulsion of hundreds of Palestinian Bedouins from a village in the Negev desert to make room for expanding Dimona, a majority Jewish city, a move described by the Zionist regime authorities as an evacuation and by critics as ethnic cleansing. Haaretz reports the Be'er Sheva Magistrate Court recently approved the Israel Land Authority's bid to force the removal of around 550 residents from what the Zionist regime authorities call the unauthorized Bedouin village of Ras Jarabah. Judge Menachem Shahak rejected the villagers' claim that they and their ancestors have been living there since before the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948. Adding insult to injury, Shahak ordered the villagers to pay more than $30,000 in legal fees. Heba Morayev, Amnesty International's regional director for the West Asia region and North Africa, said in a statement, "This judgment shows how Israel's deeply discriminatory laws around land and property ownership are used to enforce apartheid against Palestinian citizens, who are systematically denied the same rights as Jewish. The clock is ticking for Ras Jarabah residents, who have just months to pack up their lives and leave the only homes they have ever known to make way for the expansion of the Jewish majority city Dimona." She continued, "It is yet another attempt by Israeli authorities to minimize the Palestinian presence in the Negev under the guise of development." Morayev added, "This judgment underscores the need to dismantle Israeli regime's apartheid system right now. The international community must put pressure on Israeli authorities to scrap these cruel plans and end their policy of forcibly evicting Palestinians in the Negev." Ras Jarabah covers 84 acres in what Palestinians call the Naqab Desert, belonging to the Al-Hawashli tribe, who have been living there for generations. The Zionist city of Dimona, which was built on Al-Hawashli tribal land beginning in 1950s and is infamous for being the birthplace of the Zionist regime's nuclear weapons program, is seeking to expand as its population of more than 35,000 grows. The fabricated regime of Israel was founded largely through the ethnic cleansing of more than 700,000 Palestinians, sometimes by massacre, and the destruction of hundreds of Palestinian villages, an event Palestinians call the Nakba, meaning catastrophe. Ras Jarabah residents said, "We don't know where we will go." Musa Al-Hawashli told Middle East Eye, "We have been here before the regime of Israel, and now we will be expelled from our homeland." The Israel-based legal advocacy group Adala vowed to appeal the court's decision. The group said in a statement, "Since the Nakba, the state of Israel has employed a range of tools and policies to forcibly displace the Bedouin residents in the Naqab. One Bedouin village, Al-Araqib, has been destroyed by Israeli regime forces at least 139 times. Adala added, "The forced displacement of Ras Jarabah residents to expand the Jewish city of Dimona, which was built on the residents' lands, serves as clear evidence that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid against its Palestinian citizens. An urgent international intervention is necessary to halt it." According to Middle East Eye, at least 300,000 Palestinians live in the Negev region and say that the Zionist regime authorities have attempted to force them out and destroy their nomadic way of life for decades through various tactics. These include confiscation of lands from native Palestinians and turning landowners into tenants. Additionally, the Zionist regime government has been accused of preventing the expansion of Palestinian villages and encircling them with new Jewish settlements. The goal of the Israeli regime government is to take control over Arab land in the Naqab and to expel entire communities from their land. Yusuf Al-Ataune, a Palestinian member of the Israeli regime parliament with the Hadash Tal coalition, told Middle East Eye, adding, "This has been ongoing since 1948 and some families have been displaced twice." The MP said he is collaborating with a Negev-based committee to organize a larger-scale protest over the expulsions and projects taking place. He said, "People are very angry over the racism that is taking place." He added, "But despite the difficult circumstances, fines and displacements, people are remaining steadfast and strong," predicting that the recent court decision will likely inflame tensions in the Negev.
When your horse returns to our camp riderless,
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة مني ونيابة عن والدي.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves, Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyarat Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyarat al-Ashura. So stay with us.
فأسأل الله الذي أكرم مقامك وأكرمني بك أن يرزقني طلب ثأرك مع إمام منصور من أهل بيت محمد صلى الله عليه وآله.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this part of زيارة العاشورة. بأبي أنت وأمي. May my father and mother be sacrificed for you. لقد عظم مصابي بك. Indeed, my affliction due to what happened to you is immense. فأسأل الله الذي أكرم مقامك وأكرمني بك أن يرزقني طلب ثارك. Therefore, I ask Allah, who venerated your station, who honored me through you, to provide me the succor to avenge for your blood. مع إمام منصور من أهل بيت محمد صلى الله عليه وآله. With a supported leader from the family of Muhammad, may Allah pour down his mercy on him and his progeny. Regarding this part where the Zayr says, لقد عظم مصابي بك, indeed, my affliction due to what happened to you is immense, we said that we should try to realize this immense incident that happened in the tragic Ard of Karbala,
We should try to understand the personality of Imam Hussein alayhi salam as well as his lifestyle. That is when our weeping, our sorrow would be so praiseworthy that will be equal to tasbih and glorification. The root meaning of tasbih, dear listeners, depicts a kind of journey towards Allah. According to Isfahani in his Quran lexicon of Mufradat, its root meaning is al-marru as-sari' fi ibadatillah, passing swiftly in the worship of Allah. So this is the true meaning of tasbih. When you glorify the Almighty Allah, it means you are passing very fast in the worship of the Almighty Allah. Also, it is defined in At-Tahqiq of Allama Mustafavi that it says, movement in the path of truth without any deviation is called tasbih. So, these definitions, dear listeners, convey the meaning of a spiritual journey. And the only path of truth that we are certain of is the straight path. It is Siratul Mustaqim, which takes us to Allah and His proximity.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. Subhanallah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates Him, he understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So, as we concluded, brothers and sisters, true sorrow for Imam Hussein alayhi salam is equaled to tasbih and glorification. And it is said that no loftier system of spiritual wayfaring is known better than this. Do we know any kind of path for wayfaring and spiritual stations more evident than those that appear in Ziyaratul Ashura? That is why Ziyaratul Ashura is the Shi'i's prescription of a spiritual ascension. There is no need for 100 grounds, 1,000 way stations, and 200 spiritual dwellings. Inasmuch as a human being gets close and united with the calamity of Sayyidu Shuhada, and inasmuch as the spirit of the human being is affected by that calamity, it is the time that love, it is the time that attachment to this world and its positions will fade away. They will subside. This affliction of Imam Hussein alayhi salam burns away everything. That is why Nafasul Mahmum, as the tradition says, Al Mughtammu li dhulmina tasbih. The breath of the one who is grief stricken for us is glorification. That is why the breath of this one who is sorrowful due to our oppression is tasbih. The work of tasbih is purification, and it is the beginning phase of acquiring divine forgiveness. So we should really reflect on these words. sorrow over Imam Hussein alayhi salam burns off the taints of the love of the world that we live in. If the effect of our sorrow and lamentation in the mourning gatherings is contrary to that, we should try to reassess the same. Our duty would be to struggle and strive to realize the state of true sorrow by reading authentic words, by trying to understand the true words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the Ahlul Bayt, as well as the lifestyle and reality of Imam Hussein. And of course, one of the easiest ways to reach this is through the loyal companions of Imam Hussein. It is such kind of sorrow and lamentation that our esteemed scholars have always encouraged. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very interesting question, and it's something that is very pertinent for us today, especially a lot of us who are in, you know, non-Islamic countries. And we're involved in, you know, Islamic centers or mosques. This is a question that is kind of, you know, we need to understand the answer to and to see if we can find a proper an Islamic resolution to. That question is related to the reciprocal duties and rights between a leader, an imam, and the community that he leads. You know, a lot of, you know, communities in various Islamic countries, a lot of them, we can say categorically that, you know, they're complete and utter failures, or they keep failing in, you know, their efforts, and they're unsuccessful in it. And a lot of that has to do with a lack of knowledge of the subject that we're talking about right now. In other words, the community itself doesn't understand its rights and its duties with respect to their imam or their, you know, the leader or whatever. And also the imam himself, he doesn't understand it. Or if he does understand it, you know, he kind of, you know, is unable to apply that knowledge. And because of that, you know, these efforts that are made, all of this money spent, you know, in the Islamic communities, you know, result in, you know, no, you know, clear-cut and definitive progress. In this connection, we can take inspiration from a very beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, in which he elucidates and clarifies this topic. He says, "It is the duty of an imam to rule in accordance with what Allah has revealed." If we pay attention to this first duty of this leader, we see that it's actually two duties. First of all, the imam, he has to have a proper knowledge of the rules and the ordinances of Allah and Islam. If he doesn't have it, how can he rule accordingly, right? So that first condition, we can extract a condition for that leader from it. This person has to have sufficient knowledge of Islam. Unfortunately, a lot of times, these leaders of these communities, they kind of get the position by default because there's not, you know, nobody else willing to take up that responsibility. So it's just somebody kind of pops up and, you know, the people say, well, let's put this person in charge of, you know, the mosque or the center without that person really having the necessary qualifications, one of which is this, you know, proper knowledge of Islam. And the second is that the person should act upon that and he should implement it. And he should act accordingly with the knowledge that he has of these rules, and he should implement them and make sure they're being carried out. Secondly, the imam says that he delivers what he has been entrusted with, right? Sometimes there's this lack of trust between the imam and, you know, the people, because, you know, the person in charge of the mosque or the center, right, they're not carrying out their, you know, their duties properly. They're entrusted with certain funds or with certain responsibilities. They're not performing them. Then the imam says, if he does that, then it is the duty of the people to listen to him and to obey him and to hearken to his call when they are called. Meaning these people, if they, you know, if they find that this imam has his qualifications, it's necessary for them to listen to him and to follow his ordinances and his advice and, you know, his his counsel. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reciprocal duties and rights between the imam and the community in the light of the hadith and the Quranic verses. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime is turning the basic needs of Palestinians in Gaza, like food and electricity, into wishes. According to reports, with no electricity amid unprecedented heat wave, Gaza houses have become furnaces. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, It's dark as usual at night in the Gaza Strip as routine power cuts plunge Palestinian homes into darkness. But what has been different during the past weeks is an unprecedented, stifling summer heat wave. With no electricity, people are getting pushed to their limit. Dina Ahmad, 33, holds her own newborn baby. They both look sticky and sweaty. She puts her son's head in her hand, and the other hand holds a piece of paper, using it as a makeshift fan. The toddler breastfeeds, intermittently due to the extreme heat, before letting out a wail and returning to his mother's breast. Dina's three older sons understand the situation a bit better. Each of them holds up their own makeshift fan and furiously tries to generate some air. They all sit on the floor. It's much cooler than the couches. Sometimes, during particularly hot afternoons at home, Dina sprays the floor with water as they sit on the tiles for hours in wet clothes. Even though their doors and windows are flung wide open, the heat inside their apartment is unbearable, with no fans, air conditioning, or cold water in the fridge. The power is off during the day for over 10 hours. The power schedule shifts in a complicated dance at the Gaza Strip's sole power plant, struggles to ration electricity for the population of over 2 million people. It's normal for people in Gaza to spend half of their days without power now. Over the years, the electricity schedule has gradually decreased the number of hours people get power during the day. But the standard has generally been 8 hours on, 8 hours off. Last winter, the Gaza power crisis forced families to use alternative and hazardous fuel sources to heat their homes in the cold winter months. In some cases, families died due to accidents from improper use of these fuel sources. The summer is different. As demand for power increases during these months, the power company has to ration electricity even further. As Dina's family languishes in their home, they pine over the ability to have just a single fan on. Dina sighs, "Sometimes I feel that the heat can kill. I find myself imagining that my kids will suffocate." If you can't turn on a fan during the hottest part of the year, doesn't that explain a lot about how we live? She asks. The social media campaign went viral during July in Gaza as people reached a breaking point due to the extent of the power crisis. That the social media messages spread following the electricity company's announcement of a new policy requiring customers to replace their old manual electricity meter with a new smart one provided by the company. The new meter would force people to prepay to use the electricity. For many people in Gaza, in the midst of an economic crisis, that requirement is not within reach. Many people are already struggling to pay their bills on time and would rarely have enough money to pay in advance. In a press conference held in the government media office in Gaza in July, the general director of the electricity company, Maher Ayesh, explained the main issue underlying the power crisis. In short, energy needs in residential buildings and their facilities have all been increasing as the population has increased, but available resources have stagnated or, in fact, decreased in Gaza. Ayesh said, "We have been facing a growing inability to supply electricity since 2000, and that inability only increases as our limited resources decrease over time. A single power plant operates in Gaza. The total need for power in Gaza is about 600 megawatts. The available amount is 250. The Zionist regime controls the amount of fuel Gaza receives. While the messages on social media demanded that the power company improve its services, the company claims that the smart meters will benefit people, as they will optimize their use of power and increase it to 50%. Ayesh said, "The company goal is that all the 300,000 customers in Gaza will convert to smart meters by the end of 2024. We have installed 50,000 meters so far. But for families like Dina Ahmad, this won't make a difference either way." She says, "I will break the smart counter if they force us to use it. We will live in caves instead. The power company should help us instead of finding ways to overwhelm us." The Palestinian factions in Gaza have often intervened on behalf of citizens in need. This time, they held a meeting with the power company in Gaza and issued a press release after the meeting. The factions stated that the power crisis requires the efforts of all parties to end it. They also called on Egypt to support Gaza, which used to supply Gaza with power before 2018. The faction's statement also affirmed that people's needs must be put above political considerations and urged the power company in Gaza to consider people's economic conditions, especially poor families, by exempting them from using smart meters. Finally, the statement held the Zionist regime occupation directly responsible for the Gaza power crisis. Weeks after the social media messages and the faction's meeting, people's circumstances have hardly changed, and the idea of using a fan during the day remains a pipe dream. Dinal told the Mondo Voices, "When such simple things need a miracle to happen, we see how different we are from the rest of the world," pointing to her sons overwhelmed by the heat, adding, "The Israeli regime siege cut us off from the world, turning our basic needs like food and electricity into wishes."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRI.
The Navy of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps unveils new strategic defense equipment, including missiles and